Hello and welcome to the Minds on the Frontline podcast, brought to you by the Wayne State University Frontline Strong Together 5 program. The Minds on the Frontline podcast is designed to inform, educate, and entertain first responders, their families, and the public regarding the realities of frontline work-related mental health challenges. In this episode, we welcome Mike Milner and Ron Caraba. Mike Milner is a well-known retired firefighter from the FDNY that spent many years in the highly respected and highly trained Rescue 4. Since retirement, Mike has become a mental health advocate for all first responders, and he spends a lot of time sharing his experiences and how he was able to get help when he needed it most. Ron Caraba is also retired from the FDNY and finished his career as a lieutenant on 107 truck. Ron is currently a peer support team member with the FDNY's Clinical Service Unit, where he works with firefighters that need help with their mental health. Both Mike and Ron have been featured on the Gettin' Salty podcast, which we highly recommend you check out if you haven't already. This turned out to be a fantastic episode that feels like four firefighters just sitting around a kitchen table talking about mental health. If you don't know, the firehouse kitchen table is a sacred place where we tend to open up, share our thoughts, laugh, and solve all of the world's problems. We really enjoyed our time with Mike and Ron, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Good morning, fellas. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Good morning.
This is our very first Zoom podcast interview on Minds in the Frontline podcast. So I think we're pulling it off so far, the fact that we all got on here with cameras and microphones and it's being recorded. So the first step's done. Now it's time to make a cool episode. So before we do, let's lead off with the senior man, Mike Milner. Tell everybody who you are, what you do, and where you do it, or where you did it since you're retired now.
Well, I started out in the South Bronx in 77, so that was still the war years. So, you know, whether I had the line in the beginning or when I transferred over to the truck 19 later on in my career, you could always look up from the roof and see a fire right down the block still, or multiple. So I learned my trade probably the only way you really should do it, and it's hard to do it nowadays, is actual fighting fires, vacant and occupied. And then when we weren't fighting fires, we trained on vacants, cutting roofs, forcing doors, trimming windows, doing searches. So, and I learned from like World War II and Vietnam and Korean vets. So I was very lucky. And then, of course, another luck, I was taking hazmat courses with the Volleys. Rescue 4 at the time was the original hazmat. So somehow I had met them at various courses and conferences over the years. They knew me. I knew them. They came to my firehouse one day. Mike, come over to Rescue 4. And the rest is history. And then, of course, 9/11, Father's Day, I got blown out of a building. I jumped out of a window with my lieutenant. So I have not the technical experience like Ronnie does, or you gentlemen, but I do have the experience that I try to translate, that if I can get by and live and survive and prosper, like Spock, always you do this or whatever he does, if I can do it, you can do it. So I use my cred to make the person I'm talking to or the audience feel comfortable. Anyone can do it. If this lunkhead can do it, you can. And that's what I try to get across.
So that's an illustrious career you had. As you had all the experiences that most of us from 6 years old to 18 years old, right before we go into that fire service, dream of. So how did you make that transition from operational super fire dude to behavioral and mental health fire dude?
Well, you know, I would say that although 9/11 ruined my marriage, I became a horrible husband, but a great father. I'm an older dad, so my sons were only 3 and 2 when I retired. That helped me translate from the kitchen table in the firehouse to the kitchen table in my home. I still have a great relationship with my sons in their 20s. My ex-wife, and that's a part of my story, is she got me on the road to recovery. And again, I will talk about it later, but families have to be involved, and the fire service has to be willing to provide them with services. Because if you don't get the dad and mom involved, the dad ain't going to survive, or the mom. So you got to get the whole family on board if you can. And in my case, it worked out. I was able to do it, and I just kept busy. I was working for Morning Pride for a while. And then as my kids grew, I became Mr. Mom. So I was lucky. I wasn't going right to the bar to have a martini because I had something to fill the void of the kitchen table.
Absolutely. I think that's, I mean, a lot of people talk about the stuff that you learn in a book or those types of things. But I think there's something to be said about the life experience. Living through it, you can walk up to somebody and go, listen, I was in that. I was there. You know, and I think there's a lot of credibility that brings that to the forefront of what you're trying to talk about. So I think that's phenomenal that you took the opportunity to do that.
Well, I like to play it forward. Listen, if it wasn't for FDNY, I wouldn't be talking to you gentlemen or Ron. So it saved my ass, to be quite honest. All right, I got on at 25. There was a delay. They had a court case and layoffs, and some of the firemen were driving buses or taking coins at the Triborough Bridge because they were laid off and then they got rehired. But I go out of my way and I promote FDNY mental health. And prior to 9/11, there was really no mental health support. There's always something good out of a bad incident. And one of them from 9/11 is the amount of money and support and manpower FDNY put into making mental health, along with a broken leg or a broken finger, on the same level instead of being like this. Mm-hmm. And that's how we could convey today, is that departments have to make it even. One's not worse than the other or better than the other. They're even, and they have to be looked at as a disease or a problem that can be addressed. It may take time, but it can be done.
Great words, sir.
Absolutely.
All right, Ron.
Hey, what's up?
Tell everybody who you are, what you do, and where you do it.
Hey, my name is Ronald Carraba, also known as Ronzoni. I started my career in a fire service back in 1976. I joined the volunteer fire department. My neighbor across the street was a bagpiper in the band and a seated chauffeur in 27 truck. In 1973, I did my first ride-along with 27. In the heart of the war years, we had three runs on a Saturday day tour. So I officially became a white cloud from very early on in my career. Like I said, I joined the Volleys in 76, and my aspiration was to become a New York City fireman. And I didn't have a desire to go anywhere other than there. I wanted to be a part of, in my opinion, the world's best fire department. My wish came true in July of 88. I got hired by the New York City Fire Department, and I had an outstanding career, although a little bit on the short side. After 9/11, I come up short on a company medical, and they put me on light duty. I had gotten promoted in 03. I was in rank 2 years, and I was forced to retire from the job, which was one of the saddest days of my time. And after I got out of the job, I tried like heck to become a peer counselor for the New York City Fire Department, which we are now known as peer support team members. I tried for 5 years. I was name dropping a guy to the fellow Frank Lito that ran the program, and unbeknownst to me, they didn't get along. So every time I left a message with this guy's name, I never got a phone call back. And then oddly enough, one day I was at Lafayette Street, where the counseling services unit is headquartered in Lower Manhattan, talking to a bunch of guys outside, and they had said that they were looking for peers. And I reached out to Frank Lito on the phone, and he said, well, you have to come in for an interview. So I said, well, I'm standing outside on the sidewalk. He goes, come on up. When I got up, I sat down with Frank. I shook his hand. He said, so where do you work? I said, Ladder 107. And the first thing he said to me was, my father was a lieutenant there. When do you want to start? So if I had that information 5 years earlier, I would have been a peer counselor for an additional 5 years. But as we all know, everything happens for a reason. So this premise with the peer counselors, it's just a fantastic premise that they came up with. And they had retirees going around the firehouses talking about certain things, family issues, mental health, drug and alcohol abuse. They let everybody know that if you come in and you ask for help, you'll be anonymous and you'll be protected. So when I finally got out into the field, the way the FDNY would do it, they would send a new peer team person with an active team, and you would just watch and listen, and you'd get the ins and outs of what they were saying. And over time, you created your own narrative. You know, there was a few other guys that came in around the same time as me, so naturally I paired up with one of the new guys. And then we would go visit firehouses, and we would preach the word of good health, mental health, along with everything else. And quite rewarding, you know, for especially a guy like me who, you know, I didn't do a full 20 years, I only did 17 years, and my heart and soul is in this job. Being able to walk into a firehouse kitchen and tell them what you're there for and speak candidly and openly and get positive feedback. All of us in the fire service are people of service. We enjoy helping others, and we get a lot from that. So it was a natural progression for me to be able to do that. And that the environment of that firehouse kitchen is something that we all desire. because I always say the best place to be is crawling down a hallway with fire and smoke over your head. The second best place to be is around that kitchen table where we all know we can create a cure for cancer and solve all the world's problems over a cup of coffee. It's amazing what we can do, right?
Absolutely.
So, you know, that's how I got started. And over the years, early on in my peer career, I was very, very, very involved 3 times a week, traveling over 60 miles each way to get in and out of the city, visiting firehouses, doing World Trade Center medicals. We our retirees are required once a year. You're not required, but it's suggested. You go in there, you take a World Trade Center medical, and we got a bunch of old-timers like the guy on the screen with the ponytail. And we would have to show them, you know, get them on the computer, show them how to answer. You know, there's 3 different sections of your World Trade Center medical. One is a medical evaluation. One is a mental health evaluation. And then lastly, you sit in there and they go over both of them and how you did on all your testing. So helping the retirees to get navigate through the computer and answering questions that they might not have answers to. So it's been very rewarding to me. And because of that, I had the pleasure of meeting Mike Milner through Getting Salty and meeting Mike Mattern through Getting Salty. And now, Jeff, we got you here too as well. I had spoken to Mike probably 2 years ago, Mike Mattern, and you know we were texting back and forth. And he had asked about the peer support team that I was involved with. Lo and behold, I put him in touch with Frank Lito. I don't know if he actually ever spoke to him, but you guys got something up and running that is really, really, really outstanding. And it's amazing from maybe 2 sentences on the bottom of a chat screen. And here we are, you know.
It's amazing how the world works. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're meant to meet people at certain times and certain times of your life. It always works out like that.
It does. There's no coincidences, you know, and it's just, this is how it's supposed to be. And here we are. Yeah, I got to applaud you guys for the work that you're doing. I've been watching from the sidelines and you guys got the ball up and running and you guys are full steam ahead. Everything seems to be falling into place. You know, our main objective here is to get that elephant out of the room. When we got on the job, Mike got on, well, 10 years before I did. In my time when I got on, if you went to the counseling unit and asked for help, that was almost guaranteed a CD30 on your locker, which is a transfer slip. Take your show somewhere else. You don't have what it takes, you know. And over the years, that's been a downfall to a lot of guys. They were afraid to open up. As Mike had mentioned earlier, after 9/11, our counseling services unit went through the roof. We saw over 10,000 family members, along with all the firefighters, and internationally known right now. I've witnessed firsthand how FDNY has been to Germany, over in different parts of Europe, and here in the United States. A little known fact I'm not sure you guys know about, I might have mentioned it, but when we lost the Charleston 9 a few years ago, FDNY CSU sent a peer team there, and these fellas lived there for 6 months in a hotel, and they got their peer support team up and running down there in Charleston.
Wow. That's amazing.
It is amazing.
That's a brotherhood right there.
So unfortunately, the careers you guys have experienced have put you through those things to have to fix this problem we're all dealing with at this point to some degree. But those experiences allow you the opportunity to kind of set the stage of what we might expect as we continue through our career. You know, Mike and I are creeping up on that 20 year, and we've learned a lot up until then. But we got this next phase where we kind of crescendo and then go into our retirement. So there's this new set of challenges I'm starting to face as I get older. And then these young bucks coming up through the ranks that are either new or in that first 5 years are just being introduced to some of these stresses. So let's start with you, Mike. Based on that experience, can you describe, like in your own words, the spectrum of mental and behavioral health challenges that first responders or their families might experience throughout their career? What are you in for?
Well, I think every family is different. My ex, Melissa, and I just spoke to her yesterday at a wake we attended. She was my promoter. To this day, you hit her, she's like a junkyard dog. So it's very hard. I mean, not every family or father and mother get along. They raise their family. They have problems with their kids. It was a mitzvah. Let me use that word. I'm half Jewish. I was just a lot of luck. you know, like I'm not into astrology and all that, but there are a lot of things that were aligned, whether it's Jupiter and Saturn or Sagittarius and the Big Dipper, Little Dipper. I was just very fortunate that I had a wife who then became my ex that was my supporter, led me to mental health support. And, you know, my kids are fairly normal as a result of me getting some help. You know, I only can speak for myself, but I will say this. There are a lot of people that do fall off the table. All right. They may have gotten divorced after a major event. I know after 9/11, a lot of guys got divorced. The fact that the widows of the fallen of 343, the majority were married. I talked to some of those kids. Now, some of the kids came out okay. Some didn't. It doesn't mean the mom or the father or the surviving spouse did anything wrong, but that's a big trauma. You know, in my case, unfortunately, I had multiple trauma, not even 9/11, but Father's Day being blown out of a building, jumping out of a window, my lieutenant died, I survived. There's a lot of survivor guilt that gets involved. Sometimes you're act out of social events because the widow doesn't like you anymore. You lived, my husband died, so there's a little animosity involved. I mean, it's an onion's worth of layers of issues. So to get mental health support for yourself, it can be an easy path, but there's a lot of distractions. As I just mentioned, family, being X'd out of social events. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's my path. I was just very, very lucky. And Ron can speak for himself. But all I can suggest is guys like you, Ron and I in the city and other departments, if you're aware of problems, get the help. It's out there. Don't deny yourself. And fortunately, I've had guys call me to say, hey, Mike, how you doing? They're not calling me to say how I'm doing. They're calling me because I am always accessible. Every time I talk, I say, listen, I'm not a professional, but you want to call me? And they like calling me because I actually answer the phone and it doesn't go to voicemail. And that's a big deal. So when I call and they call me, how you doing, Mike? All right, what's your problem, Bobby? It's about them and that's what it should be. So that's all I can say right now. We'll get to more questions, I'm sure.
No, I love
it. I love it. No, you're good.
No, there are no right or wrong answers, right? But Ron, let's hear your take on that. Based on your experience, what are first responders and their families in for potentially? And I'm talking like all of them, from the volunteer to the professional, from rural to as urban as it possibly gets. What does that potential thing look like for our communities of first responder?
First and foremost, everything that we experience is a cumulative effect on us, right? In the pre-show, when we spoke about getting it out there to the new folks that are coming on the job now. So what we do in the FDNY is we go to probationary fire school while they're in their classrooms. They give us the auditorium and we pitch the candidates on mental health, things that you can expect, how you should react to certain things, you know. So early on, you know, when I got on the job, nobody came to the academy to say anything about anything like that. And I joined the volunteers in 1976, and it's even less of a spectrum there. I know Mike's a big proponent of pushing this for the volunteer services because they don't have a structured environment like a paid municipality. So mental health and the things that we experience are cumulative, and it affects the whole family, you know. You can come home from a horrific day and be in a really bad mood and the wife says the wrong thing. And next thing you know, you guys are feuding, you know, because you don't know how to handle it. You don't know how to dump this problem. You don't know how to suppress it. We really don't want to suppress it. We want to be open about it and we want to be able to purge, get rid of it, get it off your chest, you know. And the problem is with this stigma of going to the counseling services unit, you know, that you don't really have what it takes. So a lot of firefighters are going to suppress that instead of talking about it. As a whole, after a run, we sit around the kitchen table and we talk about it. We off gas, called gallows humor, make light of a terrible situation. And that's how we get by it, you know. But some people like to swallow it and keep it inside. Now that we're in the forefront here and we're trying to get this pink elephant out of the room, I say that a lot, it's more acceptable. It's more acceptable for us to talk about it. It's more acceptable for us to acknowledge it. When I was very active as a peer pitching firehouses, we would get the firefighters to understand what we were saying with simple terms. Listen, if you hurt your shoulder, you're going to talk to an orthopedic doctor. If you have a heart problem, you're going to talk to a cardiologist. If there's something going on mentally in your mind or in your heart, you're feeling uneasy, you have to be 100% when you're at work, because a lot of things go into what we do. The way we fight fires in the New York City Fire Department, order of arrival, type of building, location of fire. If one of those things gets missed, that compounds the fire operation. So if you're not able to be 100% on your game because you're worried about a family problem or a personal problem, we tell the firefighters, listen, this is another tool in your toolbox. Use this to your advantage and don't put a dark cloud over it. It's just another way to help you. And when people accept that and understand that, as we push forward and we keep doing what we're doing, this will be easier down the road for others. And one other thing I just want to touch on that you had mentioned earlier about us being at the twilight of our career, and now we have these young firefighters coming into play. I don't mean this with any disrespect, but it's generational. You know, the way I was raised and the way Mike was raised versus the way you guys were raised, because you're a little bit younger than us. This new generation, it's just a completely different world across every imaginable spectrum. And the work ethic is different. This seniority thing that we have in the fire department, senior man, well, you know, a new fella or a girl coming in, well, why do I have to do it? How come they're not doing it? You know, and they don't understand that pecking order and that premise of how tradition as well, you know. So moving forward, we're out here talking about it. That's a big plus. But we also have to be cognizant of the fact that this younger generation, they think a little differently than us. Their mindset is completely different than mine. I know that. So we have to handle that with kid gloves as well and make sure that we can mold them as well.
Absolutely. I think the two biggest things that you hit on that we talk about all the time is the first thing is we just don't know how to talk about it. At the firehouse, we could talk about a lot of things, but we don't know how to talk about if something bothers us or makes us look weak or whatever it might be. That's what I think you guys coming on here is phenomenal, is because you guys are old school guys. You know what I mean? You guys.
Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, I say that with respect. No, you know what I mean?
Yeah. We all did.
It's a compliment.
But I think the other thing that's been missed along the way here, you hit the nail on the head, and well, actually both of you guys hit. Everybody wants to look at the stuff that goes on at work and how it affects the first responder, but it's also the stuff at home. Like, you've got a life outside of work. If you got something going on outside of work and then you compound the cumulative effect of the things that you see at work, there's no way you're ever going to be able to carry all that. You hit the nail on the head, and I love that you brought it up, was it's not just the first responder, it's the family on top of it because of that fact. It's that whole person approach to whoever you're trying to help. It's not just work. They might have a sick kid at home. They might be going through a divorce. One of their parents might have cancer, and that's just their life, and now they're coming into work. I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that's one thing that's been missed over so many years, is everybody just thinks about the traumas that you deal with at work, and no one ever thinks about, well, who are you as a person when your shift ends or you go home? There's a lot of stuff that people are going home to on top of it, and I'm glad it's finally being brought up.
I will say this, though. Ronnie and I and Mike brought it up about family, I think if we're going to put together a mental health program for a fire department, you really have to start at the basement and work up. If you can get from the get-go, make a game plan for firefighters who need help, immediately their family is involved, children and wives or husbands, and then you build it up from there into a roof of a house. I think that's the only way you really want to start to have a successful program. Because in my case, my wife was very involved, and it helped me get through this. She led me to the right psychologist, and it took me a lot of psychologists to find the right one. I think that's a part of the way we should approach first responders. Get everybody involved, as Ron said, and then you build up from there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now,
based in your experiences, you've gone through a long career before peer support was even two words we strung together in the firehouse, right? So there was the obvious thing we're talking about before. It was cool to say, I need help. And then it's been a number of years since this program has really rooted in your department, as well as grown and become kind of a leader in this. So tell me what the department feeling was like prior to this type of thing being accepted versus now. Give us that compare and contrast.
Well, as I mentioned before 9/11, the counseling unit was there, and more or less it was a dumping ground. If there was a problem firefighter somewhere out there, they would get them off the chart, get them to the counseling unit originally, and then get them to a firehouse or a location where it was almost like a no-show type of job, you know, where you weren't online, you weren't in a fire company, and they were kind of just keeping you in limbo. You know, if you asked for help, it was the worst thing you could do because it was a sign of weakness, you know. You don't have what it takes. Maybe you should go somewhere where it's a little more slower or quieter. The mentality, it's just, you know, and the reason why it was like that is because that's the only way it was up until the need really came into play. When 9/11 happened, I mean, the whole world was stunned, you know, and the New York City Fire Department was on its heels. You know, I wasn't there when they first started the Pier Count. I was still an active duty guy. And so early on, you know, just that stigma. The thing that we're trying to erase, and here we are, it's 2023, and we're still trying to dust that off and put it on a plate and make it presentable. And I think we're on track now. You know, prior, before this 9/11 and everything else, it was just CSU was like taboo to an active duty fireman.
You know? Now, before 9/11, obviously, after 9/11 happened, it was one of those things where it was well known this is going to need to, something needed to be done. Mm-hmm. Was that something that came from the members and said, hey, we need this? Or is it something where CSU stepped up and said, these guys are going to need this? We need to change what we're doing.
The medical office, you know, the FDNY, we have our own doctors. Everything is pretty much in-house. And if you need treatments, they'll send you to an orthopedic or so. We even have orthopedic doctors as well. But I think the powers that be, the counseling unit at the time, along with the medical division of the FDNY, they probably realized what we were in store for in the coming years, and they put their minds together, and they got this thing off the ground, you know?
So they changed it for themselves. They knew what it was before. They saw the need and said, hey, we need to change what we're doing.
I can't say exactly. I'm assuming that it went that way because there'd be no, in my opinion, I don't think it could have happened any other way. They had a counseling unit that was considered a dumping ground, for lack of a better term. Yeah, I'm sure they did some good along the way, but majority of it was the need wasn't there. And after 9/11, you know, the writing was on the wall, and the powers that be, you know, they saw that this is something that we must address because it's coming at us like a freight train. And they did it. I'd really like to know, and I'm going to ask the next time I'm at a peer support meeting, who came up with this idea? Because it just makes perfect sense.
Why didn't we think of it before now type thing?
Yeah. I know.
Prior to 9/11, I was blown out of a building on Father's Day, and two of my friends died from Rescue 4, and John Dowling died from 163, I believe. So I was mentally beat already from Tom Williams and my jumping out of a window years earlier. So I tried, I went down to Metro Tech, and I tried to get out on, you want to call it Section 8 or whatever you want to call it. But at the end of the day, to Ron's point, it was like, it ain't happening. And I was hurting. And then when 9/11 came about, it only doubled my pain in many ways. I realized just from my own mental health feelings, it was time to get out. And within a year after that, I was out. And I'm glad I got out. But that's part of the problem we had prior to 9/11. As Ron pointed out, was go to the rubber room, get lost, or they put you in a company in a certain part of the Queens or Staten Island where it was almost like a lolly house, but you didn't do any work. And that's where they put you for a while. And hopefully you got better. And most times, I don't think you really got better. They just got rid of you and you were out there and they didn't have to deal with you anymore. So fortunately, as Ron said, after 9/11, whoever started the impetus to get it going, believe me, now they treat you with kid gloves, with respect, and their goal is to make you better and return to full duty if they can.
So do you feel like it's become more of a healthcare system than it was like a place to put people who are saying they're having a hard time?
Oh, it definitely was a dumping ground. It was like prior to the 2000 when they started closing mental health institutions that the states ran.
Yeah.
And they let you out. Yeah, it was draconic. It was old. The real answer in those days was have a scotch at the kitchen table with the boss. Go back to work. believe in asking the important questions.
Their home kitchen table for those
those home
legislators
tables.
Listening from
yes
home.
Allegedly
yeah. So I'd like to bring up another group that is here to help us beyond peer support, and that's culturally competent clinicians. Those people who have never gone on a fire run or any type of first responder run, but have dedicated their time to understanding our culture and truly helping us. So how do culturally competent clinicians play into this for you guys? How many of these humans are you actually utilizing, or is this all peer support driven?
The FDNY has satellite locations. We have a total of 5 locations where firefighters can go to get mental health. And in those satellite locations, they have clinicians that have certain degrees in mental health. We have a few psychiatrists on board, psychologists as well. You know, there's been guys that I've worked with as peer counselors have studied and become clinicians. We have 2 personnel which started out as clinicians and then became firemen and are still involved in CSU through the peer support system now. And they see regular clients. You know, we have that luxury that we can ask a firefighter, do you want to speak to another firefighter or do you want to speak to someone anonymous? You know, the personnel that are clinicians that had no fire background, they've been taken in under the auspice of their credentials. And then as time went on, as when I first became a peer counselor, I didn't know anything about pitching a firehouse. And, you know, you shadow 2 people, come up, you watch what they say and do, and that's how you learn how to do it. So I don't know what the exact number is, but I'm going to say somewhere in the area, probably between 20 and 30 clinicians, maybe, I would think. I might be guessing a little high, but it's a vast amount of people in those positions, along with higher education through the psychologists and psychiatrists that the job employs as well, you know.
You know, I've met a number of really good ones. And I've also met a few that aren't so good. You know what I mean? So yeah. I know how we vet them out. Do you guys vet them out, or do you just kind of like, oh, you're qualified? Is there a process of making sure these are the right humans to allow access to our personnel?
I don't have that answer for you, but I would imagine there's a system, or I'm sure they cull through the selection, and they, you know, some people just don't fit the mold, you know? And that becomes evident, I guess, over a couple of weeks. So I don't know exactly, but I've spoken to a few clinicians, different clinicians throughout my career, both on the job and off the job for my needs. And everyone that I've encountered, they seem to know the nomenclature of the fire department. They get the lingo. So they seem to be the ones that have passed the test and are able to take care of New York's bravest.
The way I look at it, and Ron's right, but I also feel that departments get these mental health programs off the ground and they're going to hire clinicians. I would think that what helped the clinicians out a lot would be either right along with the fire department chief or go to the kitchen table or come to the training center and watch what they do on a daily basis to add to the nomenclature that they may learn the lingo and actually see them stretch a line, climb a ladder. So that when these folks do come in to help, the folks may feel more comfortable because now the clinician can say, well, you know, I was at the training center for a week. I'm a very admired of you gentlemen and ladies. I kind of understand you now. So if you want to open up, I think I can help you out. I think that would go a long way too.
And you hit the nail on the head. So with our peer team, that's actually what we do. We'll meet with them first on a, like face-to-face and have a conversation with them. We talked about this before. We're very good at picking out if somebody's BSing us. If they pass the first test, that's exactly what we do. You come do third rides with us. You go on runs. We take you down to the training center, the whole deal. We let them know, hey, we want to learn who you are, you know, but we also want you to learn who we are. And I'll tell you, sitting them down at the kitchen table and letting the whole crew fire away at them.
Honestly.
And seeing us in our true environment, not what you think our true environment is.
Every thought.
Every thought, everything that comes out of our mouth at that kitchen table, it's been a game changer in a couple ways. One, we found those clinicians who were very good at doing an interview, but when they sat down with us at the kitchen table, and there's some analytical thinkers, so we read that a mile away. Well, what did we do? We just started firing questions and short-circuited them. That's not the person. We've had others that sat in the kitchen while we're busting the chops of the cook, and all of a sudden I'm like, so, you know, how was your day? And they're like, I can't believe how mean you are to each other. And it's like, don't call us. We'll call you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That was us saying, I love you.
Yes. But the flip side of it is when we try to get people in to see those clinicians, it helps in the fact that they go, well, who are you going to send me to? And I'll say one of the names. And they're like, is that the one that rode with us a couple weeks ago? I go, yeah, yeah. You met the person at the kitchen table. You know what? I'll give her a shot. And that's, You hit the nail on the head. I think if the clinicians really want to work with first responders, firefighters, police, whoever, you need to get into their environment and you need to live in their world, because that buys you a little street cred when it comes time as peer supporters. It's not just some random clinician, because let's face it, we've all been to those clinicians that are like, you tell them your story, they're crying, you're handing them the tissues, or they just, you know, want to throw pills at you, whatever. But I think the fact that you can get them in there, it's that game changer of, you know, the person. It takes the stigma away. Everybody thinks they're going to lay you down on the couch. And as we talk about this, we're all in agreement. Everybody should have access to resources. We just talked about a little bit culturally competent resources, but in your own words, when we talk about a well-organized, like, mental behavioral health peer support system, how does that look like to you guys? If you were to design that system, what are these components that you guys think are the main components that should be in those systems?
We're kind of talking about everything as we're going along here. I mean, first and foremost, just having retirees as peers, bringing the message. You walk into a firehouse, it's instant credibility. You taught me at the fire academy. Oh, we got on the job together. Oh, we got promoted together, you know, one of the boys. So just coming from within. And I really want to hug the person who came up with that idea, but it's just fantastic. I always say this, you know, if you and a blonde-headed girl walked into a firehouse, now, hi, we're with the peer support team. We want to talk about drinking and drugging and family problems. They'll pitch the firehouse, give them their thoughts. Okay, anyone have any questions? Oh, thank you. Have a nice day. And they leave. Guys aren't going to walk out, follow them on the apparatus floor, and try to explain themselves to them. It doesn't work. Mike Milner and I walk into a firehouse together as peer guys. It's credible beyond belief. People don't open up around that kitchen table. You know, you pitch them, we leave our cards, we leave any material, handout material that we have. And as we're leaving the firehouse, someone's on your six, you get a tap on the shoulder. Hey, listen, now we have someone asking for help. And I'm always very clear in the fact, and I use this terminology, in this kitchen, I have the same degree as you, slicing onions and breaking balls. I'm not a clinician. I don't have a psychology background. I'm talking to you from firsthand information. I use the counseling services unit for myself and for my family, both while I was on this job and now that I'm retired. I'm just a messenger. I'm going to tell you what they can do for you. I'm going to tell you what they did for me. And then here's the number. We point them in the direction. And then from there, they're on to clinicians. They're on to people that can help them. And we live to fight another day. Go out the door, knock on another firehouse, and do it all over.
So would you say that one of the primary components for it to be successful is having the right ambassadors between the services and what's available and the humans that need it? To be like, yo, here's what's really up. When you're ready, if you're ready, just here's the door. That's it.
Absolutely. That, to me, is everything. When one of the members uses CSU to their advantage, and then the peer support team shows up and they start talking, and this firefighter will chime in and say, I was there. This is what they did for me. And it's a snowball effect. Takes on a life of its own, and it just rumbles along. Over the years of visiting firehouses, I've been confronted by angry firefighters that have said, I went here and I called them and you said this wasn't going to happen and this ended up happening, you know. And let's face it, you're going to have disgruntled customers, employees that, you know, not everybody is going to like what we tell them. For 90% of it or greater, it works fine. And the one thing that we stress to our members as well, if you ask for help, you're protected by federal law. You cannot get fired. You cannot lose your job. If you got some guy or girl that's done this 15 times in a row, there might not be another try after that, you know?
That's a different thing. There's some underlying issues there.
Absolutely. But for the most part, it's a well-oiled machine, and it's just the mindset and the thought process that got us to where we are today. It's amazing. A proven fact is just looking at you two guys right here. But when did you start your program up? 2 years ago?
5 years ago we started.
Oh, I'm that old. I forgot.
I caught you a couple years after we had started.
Okay.
Yeah, we had 2 years in, I think 2 or 3 years in when I finally contacted you. Because I remember contacting you. I remember you put something in the chat that you did the peer support. And I wanted to pick your brain to see what we weren't doing that we could improve ours for. That's been a positive of all of this is the networking that goes on. Everybody's willing to share information with everybody else. It's been amazing. No matter what peer team I talk to across the country, everybody's willing, like, hey, this works really well. This hasn't worked. But you know what I mean? It's being built from the bottom up from all of us. With that in mind of we're doing this for each other and we're helping each other build the same thing. You know, there might be little twists here and there, but we're all doing it together. And that's one of the coolest things that I've come to realize networking with people. Everybody's willing to share. Everybody's got the same mission. You know what I mean? And that's been one of the cool things about it. But Mr. Milner over there has been sitting patiently.
I was going to say, Mike, your turn.
Ronnie's comments and yours, Mike. I did do a couple of runs with a couple of peer counselors from Fort Totten. I went to Brooklyn a few times with Charlie and Jack. I'm not going to mention their last names, but they're great guys. I
work
with
two great guys.
Shout out Charlie and Jack.
Yep.
You know who you are.
But I also know, and I think this has to be part of the game plan. When I went, we went to about 10 firehouses in Brooklyn, and everyone was a little different vibe. Some didn't want to sit at the kitchen and listen to us, and as Ron says, we don't force anything. It's more of just a kitchen table talk. We're walking in, part of the team, and we just came from a run, and we're sitting down having coffee, bagels, and talking. But I also did notice that some guys just moved into the apparatus floor and did something else. If we came during lunch, some of them were cooking or doing something else, but I think they were listening, but they didn't want to admit to anybody or themselves that they were. So I think people that are going to be peer counselors and go from firehouse to firehouse have to realize one shoe doesn't fit all. Everyone's different. It's because of the team itself or the leadership, the captain, the lieutenant in each firehouse, engine from truck, engine from rescue. They all got different mindsets. So that's got to be part of the education for the clinical guy or girl coming out to the firehouse. They have to know not only the nomenclature, but the different types of personalities in an engine, a truck, or a rescue. That's got to be part of the teamwork that we put together.
Absolutely. And I think that the last
point,
one of the points that, I mean, you bring up the teamwork, but I'm sure it's with you guys, any other peer team, the team is what makes it work. It's not one individual. The amount of work that the team puts in, the team that I'm on, I can't say enough about the people that I work with because it's everybody's invested in it. The team aspect, when you pick the right people to be on that team, your team is unstoppable. They can do whatever they want to do. You get that wide swath like you're talking about. People from different backgrounds, different thought processes. It's the widest brush that you can stroke. And it's one of the biggest things when you start a team is the people that are on it. It's the people. When it boils down to it, the training's part of it. You got to have the right people.
Well, can I just add one thing? I also think it's important that, you know, let's say you have a bad car accident, extrication involved, and you're whatever, or you have a bad fire and it's a fatal. And I don't want to put any more pressure on the bosses than they already have. But I think it's important that the lieutenants and captains, even the chief, make a phone call. Maybe not the next day or the day. You have to call up the guys or the girls and say, hey, you guys all right? You want to talk about the incident? And I think that goes a long way into helping them go for help, not try to hide from it or say it didn't happen to me or it doesn't affect me. So I think, as you said, the teamwork, Mike, there's just a lot going on. And I hate to put more pressure on the officers, but I even got phone calls. I had nothing to do with a problem. Captain would call me up or talk to my wife. And it was great. So I think that's got to be added into the mix here somewhere down the line where we get the officers actively involved to rehash it offline, out of the firehouse. Just call to make sure my team is okay.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of those things, the full approach teamwork on this is huge. From the top down, how are some ways that you guys, in your opinion, can get the chiefs on board, the city halls on board, the mayors on board,
I think that there's a lot of chiefs and township supervisors, city halls, mayors that want to support people. They want to think they are, at least. And sometimes they don't know what that looks like in reality. So how do you leverage the reality of what we have going on and getting them involved to actually fortify the services that are being created around them?
I think, unfortunately, what has to happen, or it does happen majority of the time, a catastrophic event like 9/11 or Charleston wakes up people. Mayors, fire chiefs don't like to be embarrassed. They're the head of the team. They want to look good to their people, whether it's the fire department or the people voting for them. But that's usually what happens. That's the changing point for many departments, is a very serious incident that makes them have to go in that direction, whether they want to or not. You got it, Ron. You know more than I do.
You know what, Mike? I really can't add too much more than that, but definitely after a tragic event, you know, there's a mad scramble immediately after, trying to figure out how we're going to deal with this and how are we going to be able to recognize this down the road, you know? Very plain answer and straightforward, Mike, but that's really it. You know, one thing, chief officers start out as firefighters. So they're getting that experience of the kitchen table. You know, now he's in headquarters sitting behind a desk. He's not in a frontline company. They all start out the same way, you know? So from that aspect of it, from them being exposed as firefighters, company officers, battalion chiefs, and so on, your experience will build with every year and every event that you're part of, and that all comes into play as well. To try to sell mental health in this day and age, it's just easier because it's a frontline talking point and everybody's concerned with it. That alone, you know, and what you said, Mike, I think you're right there, right on point with it. You know, I really can't speak from the chief of department's point of view because I only made lieutenant. So, you know, but I assume that that's how it goes, you know, right. If you want to add something on top of that, Mike.
I think the other part of it, and Ron knows I talk about it a lot, there is a difference between being in the volleys and being a professional, not because they're less smart or more smart than you or I, or the people on the panel here today, but their environment is different. We go back to the firehouse. Many large departments do have clinical people to help you if you have a problem. Most volley departments, especially in the rural areas, don't. And when you have a catastrophic event in the volleys, they may not see the firehouse again for another month. They may only do 200-300 incidents a year. So that guy may just get lost. And that's another reason why the volunteer fire chiefs should be in their curriculum when they go through the ranks. Many of them have state fire academies that they have to go to get courses to continue in their career, that they should be giving courses on mental health awareness at the minimum. So that if you just see something a little bit off, you haven't heard from him, or someone at the deli said, you know, Mike was a little weird last time he came in for coffee, that's when the chief or the captain of that volley house has to get involved and make a phone call. Because waiting 1 week, 3 months is too long.
Yeah. Especially for those communities that you don't see each other every day for 24 hours, right? When I worked on a paid on call department, I'd see a person maybe once a week for an hour versus spending 24 hours with my buddy and noticing all the details. Yeah.
The dynamics is different for the volleys.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I know the professional guys, I don't worry about them as much as I worry about the volley, because I also was a volley for many, many years. But talking to guys from FDIC, you know, they're down to 16 guys in a firehouse. They're driving 20, 30-year-old apparatus and equipment. So they definitely have no money to worry about your mental health.
Right.
And unfortunately, that should be right up here, right in front of their helmet shield. That's what they should be worrying about. You know, the bumps and bruises, you know, you can, you know, get rid of that, you know, soak a hot tub or even a martini like I do. But at the end of the day, they don't have that support. And I know you're going to work on that. I know from talking to you guys several times, I know that's on your agenda. But it is a little bit of a different animal that has to be addressed in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that we're working on in the state, is everybody going through Fire Academy will have some type of mental health training. Just for that reason. We don't care if you're paid on call, volley, full-time, paid, career, it doesn't matter.
Or their family members.
Yeah.
And you're right, guys, because to Jeff's point, You know, they're not sitting around a kitchen table, and that's not their profession. They're either carpenters, they work in Walmart, or they have their own side business or full-time business. So they're focused on their family and their business first, and then what happened at the firehouse at that specific event. So they are a different animal that deserves the same amount of encouragement and help that we get as professionals.
We're all humans. I don't care what patch you wear. I don't care what profession you are part of in the frontline five. We're all humans. You got to take that kind of stuff out and take care of the person behind the uniform. That's the biggest thing. We're all one family. We all go through shared experiences, and that's how we really have to take a look at it. Nobody gets less than the other.
So, you know, one of the things, the stresses of this job is from being willing to help and provide service comes along with a little bit of baggage, right? So that same thing can be said if you're a peer support team member. The weight you carry being a peer support team member and listening to some traumatic things or listening to other people's problems can get difficult. And then on top of that, you can't save everybody, and nor should you try to save everybody. So what advice can you give for current and future peer support members to maintain their own sanity?
You definitely have to off gas as well. You know, my very first experience as a peer counselor, I dealt with a guy that drove me. He was one of my chauffeurs when I covered in his firehouse, and he ended up taking his own life. And I spent a solid month, 4 to 6 times a week on the phone with this fella, anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour and a half, trying to talk him down off a crazy mountain, tell him that, you know, if nobody cares about you, I do, but the firehouse loves you, cares about you. Frank Lito had a hand in that. It was both of us trying to get this guy to come in. And in the end, he took his own life. And I asked that exact question to Frank Lito. I said, where do you go when you have to dump your stuff? Because Frank ran the entire counseling services unit. And he told, you know, go sit down and talk with somebody. You know, we're promoting mental health. We're trying to release the stigma. So it's just natural that after being out there in the trenches, listening to people dump their woes and stories, it's cumulative for you too. So you should go and sit with somebody. I can call Mike Milner on the phone and say, hey, Mike, this is what's going on. And, you know, you definitely have to be aware of it. And you definitely have to have an avenue to get to be able to clear your mind so that you can get back up on the horse and get out there and help. It's definitely cumulative for all of us, you know.
If you're gonna walk the walk and talk the talk, you got to do it for you as much as everybody else.
100%.
Yeah,
exactly.
You know, that's one of the things I worry about with this guy. This guy goes on a lot of calls when he's on duty. That's enough, and then he's taking on everybody else's concerns, right? I don't do any of this, so like, I don't deserve 1 ounce of credit for anything that's been built here in Michigan other than helping with this podcast, right? So guys like him are the ones receiving phone calls, concerns. Other peer support members are starting to call my man over here, so I get worried about my friends that are taking this more on. What are you doing? Like, how are you decompressing?
Ron hit the nail on the head. I think it's one of the biggest things is talking. You know, we tell everybody, you got a problem, you got to talk to somebody, you got to off gas, you got to vent. I've got my people that I call. They'll answer the phone. They know when I call, what's up? And I'll say, I just need to vent. And they know what that is. It's mandatory on our team that you go talk to somebody twice a year. Minimum. You have to go talk to somebody twice a year. And we go to the same clinicians we send people to. We're not sending you anywhere different than where we go as peer supporters.
Right.
I go talk to someone every 2 weeks because the amount of stuff that you're taking on from other people's things, you need to unload that backpack. If I'm not there every 2 weeks, that backpack starts getting heavy and you start getting stressed and that kind of stuff. So yeah. That's one of the biggest things I would say. If you're going to do the peer support stuff, you need to walk the walk and talk the talk because you're going to take on a lot of stuff on top of whatever's going on outside of peer support stuff. You know, you're talking about life outside of peer support that you're dealing with on top of the traumatic calls, on top of peer support. So you got to do what you preach to other people and have that system. And also know when you've hit your limit. When my plate's full, my plate is full. You talk about the peer support stuff. It's probably some of the most rewarding work that you'll ever do in your life because you're helping fellow brothers and sisters out to get them through something. It's probably some of the most rewarding work you'll ever do ever in your life. but it's also some of the lowest lows on the opposite side of it when things don't go like they should.
That's, you can't have one without the other, right?
You can't have one without the other, but no. you need to be able to practice what you preach when it comes to this stuff, because you're going to have the highs, you're going to have the lows, and that's how you're going to get through it. The other part of it is you can't look like you've got armor on and it's not going to bother you. If I'm at work and I go through a baby not breathing, I'm not part of the peer team. I'm being diffused and debriefed like everybody else. Just because I got some training and I've gone and done this stuff, that doesn't mean I'm immune to it. And you have to realize that. It's okay to not be okay, even as a peer supporter, and have the humility to say, listen, I'm not doing good right now. It all goes back. If you're going to talk and walk the walk, you got to do it. You know? Yeah. So that's my two cents about it.
Hit the nail on the head. You know, it's just the way it has to be. If you're cognizant of it, you'll know when you start getting a little squirrely and feeling it. And that's the time for you to put your hand up and say, time out. I need to take a giant step back, gather my thoughts, and regroup.
That's probably, that same thing is having good coping mechanisms. You know, Mike goes and plays hockey. Me and him went to a comedy show. We saw Dave Attell. It was amazing. We had those outlets where we can kind of releasing stresses when you're having those dopamine hits based in pure fun and joy, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's making sure that you're taking the time to actually enjoy your life too. You got kids, you got grandkids, you got neighbors, you got dogs, you got whatever. Go giggle outside, you know? Yeah.
The one thing that we have to understand as peer support team members is everybody can't be fixed and everybody can't be saved. My first experience, for one, you know? The one thing that drove me insane after that whole thing went down was I had begged this fella to call me before you do something. And he promised me he would, and he didn't. So immediately after that, for 2 weeks, I beat myself up with a fictitious scenario. What if he called and I didn't answer the phone, right? Then it would have been on me, or I would have made that assumption, very possibly could have. But it drove me crazy for 2 weeks. What if he called and I didn't answer the phone? I was at a job one time and I was doing a search, and what I thought was a closet turned out to be a coat rack in a doorway that took me further into this railroad flat. And at the end of the fire, when I did my walkthrough, and I said, oh, that's what this was. Another 2 weeks of beating myself up. What if that was a closet and there was a kid hiding in the back of the closet? If you encounter a closet while you're doing a search, you have to get your hand to that back wall, sweep the whole closet to make sure no one's in it. I didn't do that. And that was before the situation I had with this firefighter. I beat myself up on that. What if there was someone in there and I missed them? What if there was something, you know, there wasn't. But because I didn't do what was expected of me, I put that on me. And that bothered the heck out of me for a solid 2 weeks. What if, what if, what if? And then I let it go, you know.
Absolutely. I think that's one thing people don't realize when you get into this stuff. That's the kind of stuff that you're getting into. You do the what ifs. Exactly what you talked about. That's the kind of stuff that eats you up that people don't realize when you get into this. You don't dip your toe in it. You're jumping
in
with
a cannonball right in.
It's a cannonball right into the deep end. You're either in or you're out. There's no dipping your toe in it because you're putting yourself out there. And those are the things like you talked about. That's stuff that you're never going to forget. It's always going to be in the back of your mind. And those are the tough ones to deal with because you're taking it on. You signed the dotted line just like you signed the line when you got in the fire department. Well, what people got to realize is the stress that you take on doing this stuff. Like we've just talked about, it's paramount to take care of yourself because it can eat you up very quickly. If you don't have those coping mechanisms, you don't have those outlets, you don't have those things, this stuff can eat you up. And that's important. People listening, if you're thinking about doing it, know what you're getting into and make sure you have that support system for yourself. You're the support system for everybody else. You got to have that support system for yourself as well.
Good point. And the other thing is when there's a misstep, don't turn that into a negative. Make that a positive. Make it a learning experience.
Absolutely.
So the next time this presents itself or something like it, you can revert back in your memory. This happened and this is what I did initially. This is what I did to correct it. If you make that negative a positive, then that's going to be a plus for you and for the next person you may encounter.
Absolutely. You just added another tool in your toolbox. You may not use it for 3 years, but when it comes time, you go,
that aha moment.
Aha. Aha. Yes.
So, gentlemen, as we close out here, it's fitting to talk about retirement, speaking of closing out. And the goal for every first responder is to get to retirement and enjoy it, to thrive in those years, right? And eventually we all have that last call that we go on, and then we got the rest of our lives. When I'm on the job, I now have services available. I have my buddies I show up every day and the guys and girls that I work with that I trust that I can talk to. When you retire, you lose the kitchen table regularity. You lose touch a little bit. You're not up to speed. You're not up going through it with the guys and the girls at night getting through these calls. What advice do you have for current and those soon to be retired people to assure that they stay on that path of health?
I think it varies. Once again, one shoe doesn't fit all the feet because everyone has different issues, as you said earlier about family. Now, I was lucky. When I retired, I had a 3- and a 2-year-old. I had something to fill that vacuum for a long period of time. I don't know what the answer is because everybody's issues are different. And their experience, their traumatic experience, their family experience is all different. Their family life prior to getting married, because that usually somewhat determines how you're going to handle things, is based on how your mom and dad brought you up as a child. I didn't have any problems with my parents. They weren't violent. I don't think my father in those days in the 50s and 60s, there was never an ethnic slur. We had people of color come over once in a while. He was in the Teamsters. So, you know, you had a melting pot of different types of folks. So you have to approach everyone differently if you're going to talk to them about their issues on what they can possibly do or what they can possibly want to do after they retire. Now, in my case, was raising my children. They're still really close to me. As a matter of fact, I'm going out tomorrow. I delayed leaving today because I wanted to be on this podcast. Go out to Boulder, and I hope to see you and Jeff on my way back because I'm driving through like the south of Michigan through Indiana, coming and going. So hopefully I'll get a chance to maybe see you personally.
Come on by.
Absolutely. And let us know.
The end of the day is I was able to fill my time. I worked part-time for Morning Pride at the time. But hey, listen. If I told you I didn't go into dark depressions occasionally, I'd be a liar. I'd be a liar, and I couldn't go out and talk about it and make you feel better if I didn't tell you, listen, there are going to be dark days. No matter how well you try to make it work where it's always sunny and clear, there are going to be clouds rolling in here and there. And that's when you have to be able to cope with it, okay? So I don't have a formula when I meet with people because, like I said, everyone is different. They have their own issues after retirement. But listen, when I have a birthday greeting to give somebody and they're in the fire department, I write, enjoy the pension. Because the number one goal for Ron and I, and I'm sure he agrees with me, we have a magazine with New York's firefighters. Comes out quarterly. And on the back, it talks about people that died. They reached their shelf life. So when I see a guy dying at 90, 95, hey, he won the lotto. He only made $1,000 a month, but until he was 90, he won the Blue Colorado. And that's my goal. Listen, there is an afterlife. It's not that bad. Find a hobby. I mean, when I meet with Mike and Jeff, I'll show you my pictures. I mean, my dining room has 20,000 CDs, cassettes, and vinyl. That's my hobby. I go to concerts. I get autographs here, and I got posters. I listen to music daily, all types. So there's things you can do to fill that time. And one of them, when you want to release some of your off gases yourself because you've got a whole lot of stuff on your mind, most people tell you, I don't shut up anymore. I'm always talking. Go to the bank. I talk to the cashier. I'm on the line for McDonald's, which I rarely go to. I want to know what these kids are doing. And I think it's important to stay young, stay current, keep ears, eyes, and open to everything that's out there in the environment. That's the only thing I can say. Keep your ears and eyes open. Move forward. Stay young. You're never too old to learn and be humble.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're saying is, number one, don't be surprised that retirement's coming. Number two, have a purpose. And number three, have a process to keep your butt moving and enjoying life.
Absolutely.
It's amazing in this fire service and across the country, we are all so very much like-minded, especially urban firefighting. You get a guy that does 40 years and they have to pry his hands off the door jamb to get him to go home because you're too old. Your career is over. Now, put that on a guy with 17 years on a job who's 46 years old. When you leave the fire service, you lose your identity. This is not just a job for us. It's a way of life. It's ingrained in us. So with 17 years on a job, at 46 years old, being told your career is over, now I have to figure this all out on my own, right? So to speak. The first 6 months, I did nothing. And I did a lot of drinking, and I did a lot of stinking. So I ended up becoming a fire safety consultant for a company that did fire drills in high-rise office buildings. So that, to me, was an outlet because it was very fire department-orientated and structured. But we didn't have a fire truck, and we didn't have fires. But all the kitchen banter was there every single day. And, you know, you have to know this. And this is something that also should be talked about when we're pitching a probie class at the academy. Someday you will retire, and there's going to be a void that you should expect beforehand and not be surprised by it. And then have things in place for you to be productive outside of the world of the fire department. Becoming a peer counselor was the greatest blessing for me because it put me right back in my environment where I never wanted to leave, which none of us wants to leave. I was back in the firehouse. I was talking to firefighters, talking about things job related. So, you know, to this day, I mean, I'm out 18 years. I'm a New York City fire rider and I'm a peer counselor. My world is I played golf yesterday with 12 guys. 11 of them were fine, retired guys. So everything we do, it's all about this life that we've acquired through a job application that we now morphed into these positions and these things that, you know, firefighter, lieutenant, captain, chief, whatever. But our mindset is the same and our lifestyle is the same and our love of this great profession that we're all a part of is very much the same, which I find amazing because you can go across this country and just on the Getting Salty podcast, they got people coming in from every part of the country. And I've made friends with people from the other side over in England and London. Everybody's got the same mindset. So as you near your retirement years, you got to get your ducks in a row. You know, it's more planning. Try to get ready for that day. And it's not easy, you know, but try to have a plan even for that. You know, we have a plan for, we're here planning mental health. When I was an active firefighter, I used to constantly scenario-based train in my head. If I'm going down a hallway and this happens, I'm going to try this. If that happens, I might try that. Why? Because when something presents itself, your mind's already thinking. So the same thing for retirement. Start planning a little bit ahead of time. Get your mindset into the fact that you're not going to be doing a 24 and you're not going to be telling funny stories in the kitchen and putting flour on the ceiling fan and, you know, pranking and whatever else. There's life after death. You know, you retire, there's life. You know, I guess Mike and myself are good examples of that, you know, because we're out here and we're giving back to the career and the jobs that we so well loved. And it's important. It's important to keep this going. So
totally agree. You know, one of the things, my father-in-law did 30 years in the fire service, professional firefighter, and they still get together once a month for retiree dinners and they give you a t-shirt because it's a great idea to still have that thing. It's the same guys he sat around a table with for 30 years making fun of them because they're too short or too tall, too fat, too skinny. It doesn't matter. I'm here to buzz balls and eat the onions instead of chop them this time, right? So I think it's making sure also that you create your own firehouse in your own life. You know, you can continue those relationships. The trips don't need to stop. The baseball trips that our guys at department go on. I love it when I hear retirees go on those things. That's great.
Oh, yeah.
So that answers our question for retirees. Any closing thoughts? Mike Milner, you first.
Yeah, first of all, I like to say that, you know what? You don't have to go on pills seeing a clinical person. Okay, I see a psychiatrist and I see a clinician. I don't take the pills. Okay, I've been able to do it without it. I'm a little phobic about taking pills, but it works. So I think we also have to approach it that just because you have a mental health issue doesn't mean you have to go on meds. if that's what you need, that's fine. It doesn't have to work that way. Because I think that's some of the pushback you get from people. I got to go on meds, I'm going to be in La La Land. That's not true. Number two, there's an organization I saw at the Indy, Thin Line Service Dogs. Very nice lady and a gentleman run it. I met two of their dogs. They were the coolest retrievers I've ever met. It was a commotion 24/7, and these dogs were dead on arrival, meaning they were just sitting there enjoying themselves. But I think that's something that could be in addition to programs that are set up by cities and counties and states to have service dogs or comfort dogs to be provided if someone needs them. I know they work. So that would be a comfort for many firefighters and EMTs. And finally, I like to say that I think any department that has safety chiefs, they need to get the chiefs to have some kind of mental health awareness program or training. So when they either go back to the firehouse to talk to these guys over a traumatic incident or they're observing something going south, they know, hey, I want those guys pulled out, new troops. Or when they get to the firehouse to talk about it, if they see someone with their eyeballs going in the wrong direction, like a deer in headlights, you know what, off the record, off afterwards, have someone contact that person and say if they need or want some kind of support. Thank you.
Thanks, bud. How about awesome. You there, Ron?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, definitely an honor and a privilege to be here today with you guys. It was a great experience. What I'd like to say also, the FDNY now has active firefighters that are peers. That'll help the immediate need. So if something goes wrong and they need an immediate response, there's a computer program called the Diamond Plate. There's a computer in every firehouse. They see who's working. And every firehouse across the five boroughs, where over 2,000 strong is our on-duty working strength. And they can immediately pull from those ranks to get a peer counselor on scene as quickly as possible. So if that's not something that you guys are doing there, I suggest you look into that. And the last thing I want to say is, being on duty and on call in the groups, working with the same people, we all know everybody's nuances, what makes them tick, what makes them click. So we're the best persons to be aware of something that's out of the normal with anybody we see at work. And this also goes for at family life, home living. If you have somebody that is not the norm of what they always are, we should raise an eyebrow to it, and we should offer a hand. Listen, I noticed you haven't been yourself lately. What's going on? My wife is running away with the pool guy, and I'm, Well, listen, the counseling guys were here the other day. Here's a card. Why don't you give them a call? You know, a little bit of compassion, a little bit of humility, and awareness. Just be aware of the people that you work with and the people that are around you, because even the people that say they don't want help, their actions speak louder than their words. And you'll be able to pick up on something that is very apparent, but kind of camouflaged, you know? So just be mindful, be aware, and always be willing to lend a hand, you know?
I have one more thing to add to Ron's points. As I said, or I see a psychiatrist and a therapist. I got to tell you something. We say, hey, do it on Zoom. I personally like to go see them face to face. I get a tremendous amount of encouragement, support by spending a half hour, 45 minutes, depending on what I get for that day or month. So I think I also just want to say is, listen, if you're going to go through this program of getting help, you have to want to do it. Find the right clinician and enjoy it. Don't look at it as, I got to go, like work that you don't like. You want to find that clinician that you feel comfortable with. That's almost like your uncle or your brother. You can actually spill out some of the things you normally wouldn't tell your wife or your kids. You can tell that person. They just listen. They give advice. They don't take sides. They don't point fingers. They don't scold you for making wrong choices. And that's the last thing a clinician wants to do. Even if though you're making the wrong choices, he has to or she has to find a way to slowly make you take a left-hand turn in the right direction, then continue on the path that you want without making you feel embarrassed.
One quick question for you there, Mike Milner. You said you got two clinicians. Do they know about each other?
No, they actually do.
Do you have a side? She's got a side clinician.
I thought you had a side clinician. Is it, do you tell them, or is this like just a, like a second opinion? You don't tell them to see if it's all the same.
There is competition between clinicians.
I'm sure there is.
There is. I'm a psychiatrist. I'm only a PA in psychology. Oh, they have a battle. Believe me, like anything else in life.
There's always a hierarchy,
they
sir.
I'm glad they do.
Yes.
Yeah, be competitive, but do it to be good at your job. Well, we appreciate your guys' time today. We had an amazing time. We hope to have you back.
Absolutely.
I'm sure we'll have you back.
This is great.
Thank you to Mike Milner and Ron Carraba for joining us on the Minds on the Frontline podcast. We hope to have you boys back soon. We hope everybody enjoyed this episode. We have more great content coming out soon. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.